This is the DiGrazio podcast of Roman Roads Press, helping Christian families inherit the humanities. I'm Cooper Salmon, and I do video production and marketing, and I'm here with my co-host, Daniel Fukushan, founder and CEO of Roman Roads.
Great to be here.
So what's on the menu for today's podcast, Daniel?
So today we will be listening to the first inaugural lecture of Old Western Culture. And I emphasize listening because Old Western Culture is a video course and is very visual.
Visually rich.
Not only is Wes Callahan sitting in his library surrounded by his books, ordered in chronological order, which he allows him to brush his fingers along the leaves of time, as he says, but also the course contains everything from animated timelines that emphasize his point, especially in this lecture.
Mm-hmm. And graphics that have the authors he's talking about, a lot of dates.
Correct. As well as over 200 pieces of art per unit, especially in these earlier units that cover the epic poetry and that were inspired a lot of art throughout the centuries. As a very visual course, we didn't want to release an audio-only version of it. Mm-hmm. So this is a little bit of an exception, and so I want people to understand it is you're missing something, but you are getting the main thrust of his argument.
Yeah. So why did we pick this episode? We intentionally thought about this episode. Why did we pick this one?
So this is the inaugural lecture of Old Western Culture that lays some of the foundation for why or here, why we're studying the great books. Wes gives a bit of that overarching, first of all, he explains what Old Western Culture means, and the nature of what the great books do for us. So he explores the notion of what is truth. Are the great books sort of a consensus of truth? I won't give too much away because you're about to hear the lecture. And he basically says, why have we shown up here? Why is it worth studying these old great books? You'll hear a phrase like the clean sea breeze of the past. That's a quote from Lewis. So again, I won't spoil it, but it really answers the question of why. So enjoy this first lecture of Old Western Culture.
This course, for which this lecture serves as an introduction, is called Old Western Culture, a Christian Approach to the Great Books. And I want to say something about what that means. The Christian approach to the great books is not an approach that disagrees in general with the contemporary notion of the great books. The idea that studying the great books of the past gives one perspective is, of course, very valuable. And studying the great books does that. When we read the books of the past, as C.S. Lewis says in his essay on the reading of old books, which is found in his volume God in the Dock, Lewis says that when we read the old books, the clean sea breeze of the centuries blows through our minds. And specifically, he means that when we read the books of the past, we see how people thought very differently about some very fundamental things, assumptions that modern people share, no matter how widely they think they disagree, turn out not to be shared by people of the ancient world on very, very fundamental issues. What is the nature of the universe? Why is man here? What is his chief end? What is the purpose of life? How do we find wisdom? Who is God? What is love? What is the relationship between the individual and the state? What is the relationship between men and women, between adults and children? All these questions and many more are questions that reading the great books turn up answers to, but the answers from old authors are very different from the answers that we often have. And so what Lewis means when he talks about the clean sea breeze of the centuries blowing through our minds is simply that we're enabled to get a different perspective on ideas and on questions that we never thought about before. Since we all share similar assumptions, no matter how radically we might disagree, to find someone else who actually differs on those very different assumptions is helpful. It enables us to unearth the sort of mental baggage that we otherwise would never question. So perspective is a valuable thing. Reading the great books for the purpose of understanding what made our culture is a valuable thing. Our culture, for all the fact that over the last century we've been rejecting and ignoring history, our culture is still deeply, deeply indebted to the ideas of the past. And to read the great books of the past, to read Aristotle and his discussion of metaphysics, or Plato and his discussion of virtue and the soul, or Augustine and his discussion of the philosophy of history, or Shakespeare, or Milton, or Spencer, or Homer, or Virgil, and their discussions of beauty and poetry and power and human nature and so on. Those books are the books that shaped the people who shaped our culture. They're the books that shaped our culture. And not to know them is not to know why our culture is the way it is. So a Christian approach to the great books doesn't reject all those ideas, but a Christian approach to the great books differs in this respect. Many modern followers of the great books idea have what we might call a syncretistic approach to the discovery of truth. That is, truth comes from a variety of areas, including a sort of triangulation between the ideas of the great books. If we stand and listen to what is called the Great Conversation, the conversation carried on over time by Aristotle and Augustine and Thomas Aquinas and John Calvin and John Milton and Dostoevsky and so on, if we listen to the conversation made up of all those voices, we can come, says this approach, to truth. But a Christian can't say that. A Christian certainly agrees that we can find out valuable things from reading the ideas of the past, but a Christian finds the locus of truth and meaning and significance in Revelation, the revelation of God in the world through His Son Jesus Christ and through His church and through the Scriptures. That's where we find truth. So reading the great books can certainly be valuable, but it's not the source of truth. So a Christian approach to the great books says that we find truth through the revelation of God in the world through the means I've mentioned. And then with the revelation that's given to us by a revealing God, we can read the great books and we have some way of discerning and discriminating what's true and what's false, of separating the wheat from the chaff, of plundering the Egyptians, as St. Augustine put it. We might call the Christian approach to the great books a confessional approach. We confess the truth of Christian revelation, and then with that as the grid or the matrix or the filter, we have something at which to look at the great book, through which to look at the great books and to find what's important and what's valuable and what's not. Otherwise, we're left to our own devices, and it's every man for himself. And that very often is the case in the modern world, with the rejection culture-wide of a belief in revelation as the source of truth and meaning and significance in the modern West, in Europe and America. We see the breakdown of all kinds of understandings of standards and absolutes, and that will apply to our educational principles and methods, including whether we think what we think the great books are, or even whether there are great books. One way in which the Christian approach to the great books shows up is this. If you take a modern list of the great books, a modern canon of the great books, for example, Adler's Encyclopedia Britannica Great Books Set, and look at the selections, you see something very interesting. In his set, for example, he has works from ancient Greece, he has works from ancient Rome, and works from the very early Middle Ages, but he stops with Augustine. Now, Augustine lives around the year 400, a few decades before, a few decades after, so around the year 400 after Christ. The very next volume in the set is by Thomas Aquinas, who lives in the 13th century. So that's, what, 800 or 900 years later? A gap of 800 or 900 years. Now, why is that? Why is that huge gap there? And then, of course, in the Encyclopedia Britannica Great Book Set, there are many books from the Renaissance and the Reformation, there are books from the early modern world, and right up until around 1900. But there's this startling gap, and most people, of course, won't think about this, but a Christian will. The reason that gap is there is because the modern idea of what the great books are has been influenced by an inheritance we have from the Enlightenment of the 1700s. In the Enlightenment era, people in all sorts of disciplines, theologians, philosophers, even Christians began to reject the idea that the source of truth comes from revelation and began to think that reason, with the great power it was displaying in the sciences, could be the source of truth. And so we have the rise of deism, a religious philosophy that says that God is the great clockmaker. He wound up the universe at creation and set it ticking and then sat back. And now it operates on the basis of physical principles with no intervention from God, eliminating the idea of the supernatural or the miraculous. So deism was a major aspect of Enlightenment thinking. But Enlightenment thinking in general rejected the idea that Christian revelation is the foundation or the ground for truth. And so any age that's deeply imbued with Christian faith must be automatically a superstitious age. And that's precisely what the Middle Ages were. The Western European Middle Ages were a Christian age. We often call it Christendom. This doesn't mean, of course, that every individual in the Middle Ages was regenerate. Obviously, there was a great deal of evil, a great deal of corruption, and a great deal of wickedness. I suspect that there was not more than there is now, but that's beside the point. In the Enlightenment, thinkers looked back at the Middle Ages, an age that was obviously dominated by Christian faith, and they said, it's a dark age because it's dominated by Christian faith. Now, that's what the Enlightenment thinkers said, and the modern age, our modern world, has inherited that attitude. And so without even thinking about it, we think of all of the Middle Ages as a dark age. Now, there was a time of cultural darkness shortly after the collapse of the Western Roman Empire in around 500 AD, running up to maybe 800 or 900. But by 800 or 900 AD, we have Charlemagne in the Frankish kingdom, modern France. We have King Alfred the Great in England, both making astounding efforts to revive culture. And by the year 1000 or 1100, education is revived in a big way. Universities have started. Schools are going. The liberal arts are flourishing. Arts and architecture and philosophy are flourishing. And by the time you arrive at what historians call the High Middle Ages, 11 to 1300, we have Gothic architecture, Thomas Aquinas' Summa Theologica, and we have Dante's Divine Comedy. Three expressions in three different areas. Now, architecture, philosophy, and poetry that are as great as anything that human culture has ever produced. So all of the Middle Ages were not dark by normal standards, but by Enlightenment standards, who were thinking only in terms of the idea that in the Middle Ages Christian faith dominated, by those standards, the entire Middle Ages were dark. A Christian can't agree with this. A Christian ought to look at the Middle Ages and say, those are my people. Since the Middle Ages were dominated by Christian faith, we ought to look at them as, in some sense, an age of light. And so a Christian might look at the great books, at a list of the great books, and say there are certainly ways to fill in the gap that Adler left out of his great book set. In between St. Augustine and St. Thomas Aquinas, that is between around 400 and 1200 or 1300 AD, there are a number of great books that have tremendously influenced all of Western culture that are ignored by the modern secularist attitude toward what great is. For example, a century after St. Augustine, the last great Roman, you might say, Boethius, wrote a book called The Consolation of Philosophy, a delightful little book that explores the questions of God's providence and sovereignty and compares them with the misery that humans often find themselves experiencing. And this book had a profound influence on not just the Middle Ages, but the Renaissance as well. But it's not in Mortimer Adler's set. A couple centuries after that, in the 700s, we have the Venerable Bede, a Saxon monk in northern England who wrote what is the definitive early history of England. And all modern historians, Christian or secular, look to Bede for their understanding of the early history of England. He tells the story of England from the Roman times up to his own day in the 8th century, and especially the coming of Christianity to England. But it's a profoundly important book. Still quoted widely by historians, but it's not in Adler's great book set. Around the time of Boethius, in this same rough time period, we have St. Benedict, who wrote a little book called The Rule, which shaped all of monasticism in the Christian Middle Ages, and monasticism, of course, right up to the very present time. But the monasteries in the Middle Ages were incredibly important to the survival of ancient and of Christian culture in the Middle Ages, through the Dark Ages and into the High Middle Ages. It was the monasteries that preserved learning and the languages that had been inherited from the Greek and Roman ages and were being lost by the rest of the world. And these monasteries were formed by the rule of Saint Benedict. So this little pamphlet, which describes what a peaceful, ordered, disciplined community might look like in the middle of what was genuinely a dark age after the collapse of the Western Roman Empire, this little booklet is a great book. But it's not an Adler's great book set. One could look at St. Anselm of Canterbury in around 1100 AD, who's one of the great Christian theologians and thinkers and philosophers, one of the precursors of the scholastic movement, of which later on Thomas Aquinas will be the chief exemplar. But St. Anselm writes some wonderful short little philosophical books that are profound in their expression of what you might call presuppositional apologetics, arguments for the existence of God to encourage the believer, not to persuade the non-believer, but to encourage the believer. Arguments that have been grappled with by philosophers ever since. St. Anselm's a profound influence on the later Middle Ages. There was a genre of literature in the Middle Ages that we call hagiography, saints' writing, collections of saints' lives. Stories that are dubious in their factual and historical value, but tremendously important in their value for encouraging Christians. And in the High Middle Ages, just before the year 1300, one such collection called the Golden Legend was compiled that became the most popular book in terms of distribution and translation and copying, besides the Bible, for 200 years. And up until less than 150 years ago, it was widely known and widely read in Western culture, but it's not on anybody's great books list anymore because of the influence of the Enlightenment attitude toward what greatness is. Geoffrey of Monmouth, writing in the 1100s, wrote the first Arthurian epic. And the story of Arthur and the epic of King Arthur has been tremendously influential on the imagination of the English-speaking people everywhere in the world. And it certainly was a formative influence on Sir Thomas Malory's later version of the story of King Arthur, a more well-known version. But Geoffrey of Monmouth and his version, called The History of the Kings of Britain, was tremendously important and influential on the Renaissance and Reformation cultures, and again, right up until less than 150 years ago, widely known in our culture. But now it's not on anybody's list of great books. So the inheritance that we've had from the Enlightenment, an inheritance that says anything produced in an age dominated by Christian faith, it can't be of value, that inheritance has caused a tremendous loss. And so in this course, and it's not the only one, many Christians are going back and realizing that the idea of a great book is wonderful, but needs to be rethought. But in this course, I include a number of those stories and histories and political tomes and philosophical treatises and so forth that were produced in the Middle Ages because this is a Christian approach to the great books. Many of the great books that we'll be talking about in this series would be familiar to anybody who thinks about what the great books list should be. If you took my list and the great books set produced by Adler and the Encyclopedia Britannica, a set produced maybe by your local library. Now, you take any great books list and collate them and look at them all, you would see a great many books that show up on everyone's. Nobody can leave out Homer and not be laughed out of the room. Nobody can leave out Shakespeare or Milton or Virgil. And so there are a number of books that you might say are sort of the peaks, the Mount Everest, the high point in the range of great books. But there are many other books that should be rated higher than often are, and those will be included as well.
Well, that was lecture one. I know it had been a while since you and I had listened to that, and I had forgotten how much time he spends in that lecture just filling out the idea of explaining the idea that the Enlightenment really rejects so much of the Christian parts right. of the great books,
yeah.
And it occurred to me that the Enlightenment outlook that we mm-hmm. assume is normal, that most people assume is normal these days, basically takes all those medieval works, rejects them and says they're not important,
right.
Doesn't excludes them from great books collections, and then other people come along and go, "Wow, nothing! The medievals made nothing.
Dark ages.
Yeah, right. It's just this self-reflective. It's just reflecting the Enlightenment perspective of the medieval ages. Being really unfair to that whole period. And I was
right.
encouraged that he spent so much time filling out the actual Christian heritage of that period.
Right. And there was something that I think he addresses in lecture two or three, I think it's three, where he actually goes into more detail about the accomplishments of the medieval period, these dark ages. He really talks about that aspect in particular. So, you know, in a previous episode, we talked about inheriting the humanities. Mm-hmm. And here he's talking about the inheritance from the Enlightenment.
Mm. We're all, just by being born into the modern world, we're already inheriting all these Enlightenment ideas and perspectives.
Right. And so there is an important aspect to inheriting the humanities, which is not all acceptance. Inheriting the humanities is not let me know what good things I must believe because it's all good. Right. Part of inheriting the humanities in a Christian way with the, which is again, something he talked about, you know, what is our truth? We're not syncretists. We don't triangulate truth through the average of the great books, is understanding what in our inheritance to reject. So first you have to recognize that it is, that it's there. You have to understand it in order to reject it. So that discernment of, you don't want to throw the baby out with the bathwater, which since this is called digressio, in the Middle Ages, that phrase came from the Middle Ages. So a period where people, perhaps one dark aspect is that they didn't bathe as much. And the reason, and they would do their weekly or maybe not even quite weekly bath. And in large families, it was always like the dad first and then the mom. And so the baby was last. And so the don't throw the baby out with the bath water was because the water was so dark that you might miss the baby in the bath water.
So you started out with a bath and it ended up being a pond.
Exactly. Oh, so this is digressio.
So we are glad that we have progressed beyond
this was
that,
a digression. But. Yes. Yeah. There were some things to reject. Enlightenment philosophy and their bathing habits.
Something to be grateful for.
We are still trying to get back to the Roman baths. That's again, I digress. So the inheritance from the Enlightenment is something to recognize and reject at least certain aspects to it. So he went, Wes Callahan goes through multiple, highlighting multiple books. I actually want to go ahead and I want to take a moment to briefly read through the actual works we go through. So as we were producing this course, this was the inaugural lecture, and then we went through producing the course and had to make a few decisions along the way on what was included. Do not overwhelm children with reading. And because you can't just make an unlimited list, this is a doable reading list for high schoolers. I would say that actually puts more emphasis on what we did choose to include or exclude. Right. So
rejecting the fire hydrant approach.
Exactly. So there is between the period that he was concentrating on here that generally has no representation or little representation in most great book set. We dedicate half a year of study to incomplete units, early Christianity and Nicene Christianity, and to actually quite a bit in our next unit of Christendom, early medievals. There's several works in there that you mentioned. So in early Christianity, students.
And this is from year two, right?
Year two
of the Romans.
Yeah. So okay. Year two of the Romans, that's where you start to have that drop off. So the two units that are, for the most part, entirely left out of most great book sets are early Christianity and Nicene Christianity in our set, and also early medievals to a certain degree in the third year. So this is in the second year. This is where most of it is often left out in great book sets. In early Christianity, they read the Didache. The Didache is unknown author, the oldest non-canonical text after the close of the canon. So it's a very early text that some of the way it's written resembled the Bible, but it's very influential and gives a good peek into the early church. And then you're reading the first epistle of Clement of Rome, the letters of Ignatius, letter to the Philippians by Polycarp, a plea to the Philippians by Athenagoras, the epistle to Diognetus by unknown, the first apology by Justin Martyr, against heresies by Irenaeus of Lyon, my hometown, and which is a very famous work, exhortation to the Greeks by Clement of Alexandria, and history of the church by Eusebius, also very important work and also left out of so many great book sets.
Sad.
And then in Nicene Christianity, they're reading On the Incarnation by Athanasius, The Life of St. Antony by Athanasius, the Paschal Homily by John Chrysostom, Baptismal Instructions by John Chrysostom as well, On the Holy Spirit by Basil the Great, Funeral Oration by Gregory of Nazianzen. Did I say that right? Nazianzen. Yes. Mm-hmm. Confessions of St. Augustine. So the City of God and the Confessions of St. Augustine are ones that are more...
Too big to be ignored.
Too big to be ignored, but very important. And then the Consolation of Philosophy by Boethius, which Wes did mention in the lecture. And so those are the second half of the Romans. Year three, we're reading the Rule of St. Benedict. So this is from the early medievals. The Wars of Justinian by Procopius, History of the Franks by Gregory of Tours, Book of Pastoral Rule by Gregory the Great, The Dialogues, also by Gregory the Great, The Confession of St. Patrick by St. Patrick, Letter to the Soldiers at Coriticus by St. Patrick as well, The Life of St. Columba by Admonin of Iona, The Voyage of Brendan, that's an anonymous author, Beowulf, so that's a great book often included, Ecclesiastical History of the English People by Bede, the Venerable, Life of Charlemagne by Einhard, Life of Alfred by Esser, and The Fount of Knowledge by John in Damascus. So many of these things were incredibly influential at their time, and the students of old Western culture are reading them. And these were books that influenced the shape of history and that influenced a lot of who we are today and influenced the literature. If you're a writer, you'll see that these understanding these genres is important. So yeah, these are some of the those are just three units, and most of what I just listed is ignored by many, if not most, great book sets.
A lot of really important stuff for our Christian heritage.
The other thing I wanted to just kind of point out that from this lecture is something that Wes mentioned almost in passing, but that was really important to me, was that by reading these works that are very different from our own, you know, the Clean Sea Breeze of the Past, as Lewis mentioned, they are not... they're not comfortable to us necessarily. They're foreign. And yet, especially in this early Christian period, these are works from the Christians of this period. And at my studies with at New St. Andrews College, one of the things that really struck me is probably the number one thing that I walked away with from the history of the church with Dr. Chris Schlecht was that notion of understanding that these are our people. This is my people. If I were to go back in time to 800, 400, recognizing that they may look very different from me, but these are the people of God. And so that's something that I think is extremely valuable to even recognize the flow of history of God's people and where we've come from. We have their works. We don't, you know, we don't have to have a time machine to experience it. We can do it through these works. So yeah,
to see what's important to them, to see what they valued, what they thought about things.
Yeah.
This is our way of connecting to the great cloud of witnesses that we don't have with us anymore.
Yeah. And to, you know, one of the quickest answers to why read the great books, the fifth commandment. The Old Testament is full of commands to remember. Remember the stories. The great books, even the so a lot of these are Christian works, but even the pagan works wound throughout history, and this is the history of God's people and of God's progressive revelation given to us. This is to honor our heritage, our inheritance, you know, and our, to honor our fathers. So why read the great books? Honor your father and your mother. So it may be well with you.
Yeah. Well, I can see the light in your eyes, the passion that you particularly have for sharing these lost topics. I know you love the Romans and the Aeneid, but as far as a lot of the conversations that we have around the office, I know how much you love to emphasize these overlooked, undervalued classics of the medieval world, and I don't doubt that we'll be able to get a lot into a lot of these in future episodes, which is why I would recommend that the listeners subscribe to our podcast and stay up to date with future episodes. Thank you for listening to the Digressio podcast.
Thank you so much.
And until next time, read your Bible, read a good book, and keep inheriting the humanities.